Chapter 1, 1745-1755. The Combatants. The latter half of the reign of George II was one of the most prosaic periods in English history. The civil wars and the Restoration had had their enthusiasms, religion and liberty in one side, and loyalty on the other, but the old fires declined when William III came to the throne, and died to ashes under the House of Hanover. Loyalty lost half its inspiration when it lost the tenet of the divine right of kings, and nobody could now hold that tenet with any consistency, except the defeated and despairing Jacobites. Nor had anybody, as yet, proclaimed the rival dogma of the divine right of the people. The reigning monarch held his crown neither of God nor of the nation, but of a parliament controlled by a ruling class. The Whig aristocracy had done a priceless service to English liberty. It was full of political capacity, and by no means void of patriotism, but it was only a part of the national life. Nor was it at present moved by political emotions in any high sense. It had done its great work when it expelled the Stuarts and placed William of Orange in the throne. Its ascendancy was now complete. The Stuarts had received their death blow at Culloden, and nothing was left to the dominant party but to dispute on subordinate questions, and contend for office among themselves. The Troy squires sulked in their country houses, hunted foxes, and grumbled against the reigning dynasty, yet hardly wished to see the nation convulsed by a counter-revolution and another return of the Stuarts. If politics had run to commonplace, so had morals, and so too had religion. Despondent writers of the day even complained that British courage had died out. There was little sign to the common eye that under a dull and languid surface, forces were at work preparing a new life, material, moral, and intellectual. As yet, Whitefield and Wesley had not wakened the drowsy conscience of the nation, nor the voice of William Pitt roused it like a trumpet peal. It was the unwashed and unsavory England of Hogarth, Fielding, Smollett, and Sterne, of Don Jones, Squire Western, Lady Bilaston, and Parson Adams, of the Rake's Progress and Marriage Longhood, of the lords and ladies who yet live in the undying gossip of Horace Walpole, be powdered, be patched, and be rouged, flirting at masked balls, playing cards till daylight, retailing scandal, and exchanging double meanings. Beau Nash reigned king over the gaming tables of Bath, the ostrich plumes of great ladies mingled with the peacock feathers of courtesans in the rotunda at Ranelagh Gardens, and young lords in velvet suits and embroidered ruffles played away their patrimony at White's Chocolate House or Arthur's Club. Vice was bolder than today, and manners more courtly, perhaps, but far more coarse. The humbler clergy were thought sometimes with reason to be no fit company for gentlemen, and country parsons drank their ale in the squire's kitchen. The passenger wagon spent the better part of a fortnight in creeping from London to York. Travelers carried pistols against footpads and mounted highwaymen. Dick Turpin and Jack Sheppard were popular heroes. Tyburn counted its victims by scores, and as yet no Howard had appeared to reform the inhuman abominations of the prisons. The middle class, though fast rising in importance, was feebly and imperfectly represented in Parliament. The boroughs were controlled by the nobility and gentry, or by corporations open to influence or bribery. Parliamentary corruption had been reduced to a system, and offices, sinecures, pensions, and gifts of money were freely used to keep ministers in power. The great offices of state were held by men sometimes of high ability, but of whom not a few divided their lives among politics, cards, wine, horse racing, and women, till time and the gout sent them to the waters of Bath. The dull, pompous, and irascible old king had two ruling passions, money, and his continental dominions of Hanover. His elder son, the Prince of Wales, was a center of opposition to him. His younger son, the Duke of Cumberland, a character far more pronounced and vigorous, had won the day at Culloden, and lost it at Fontenoy, but whether victor or vanquished, had shown the same vehement bull-headed courage, of late a little subdued by fast-growing corpulency. The Duke of Newcastle, the head of the government, had gained power and kept it by his rank and connections, his wealth, his county influence, his control of boroughs, and the extraordinary assiduity and devotion with which he practiced the arts of corruption. Henry Fox, grasping, unscrupulous, with powerful talents, a warm friend after his fashion, and a most indulgent father, Carteret, with his strong, versatile intellect and jovial intrepidity, the two Townshends, Mansfield, Halifax, and Chesterfield, were conspicuous figures in the politics of the time. One man towered above them all. Pitt had many enemies and many critics. They called him ambitious, audacious, arrogant, theatrical, pompous, domineering, but what he has left for posterity is a loftiness of soul, undaunted courage, fiery and passionate eloquence, proud incorruptibility, domestic virtues rare in his day, unbounded faith in the cause for which he stood, and abilities which without wealth or strong connections were destined to place him on the height of power. The middle class, as yet almost voiceless, looked to him as its champion, but he was not the champion of a class. His patriotism was as comprehensive as it was haughty and unbending. He lived for England, loved her with intense devotion, knew her, believed in her, and made her greatness his own, or rather, he was himself England incarnate. The nation was not then in fighting equipment. After the Peace of Aix-la-Chapelle, the army within the three kingdoms had been reduced to about 18,000 men. Added to these were the garrisons of Menorca and Gibraltar, and 6 or 7 independent companies in the American colonies. Of sailors, less than 17,000 were left in the Royal Navy. Such was the condition of England in the eve of one of the most formidable wars in which she was ever engaged. Her arrival across the Channel was drifting slowly and unconsciously towards the cataclysm of the Revolution, yet the old monarchy, full of the germs of decay, was still imposing and formidable. The House of Bourbon held the three thrones of France, Spain, and Naples, and their threatened union in a family compact was the terror of European diplomacy. At home, France was the foremost of the continental nations, and she boasted herself second only to Spain as a colonial power. She disputed with England the mastery of India, owned the islands of Bourbon and Mauritius, held important possessions in the West Indies, and claimed all North America, except Mexico and a strip of sea coast. Her navy was powerful, her army numerous, and well appointed, but she lacked the great commanders of the last reign. Soubise, Mailboys, Contades, Brunoy, and Clermont were but weak successors of Condé, Turenne, Vendôme, and Villars. Marshal Richelieu was supreme in the arts of gallantry, and more famous for conquests of love than of war. The best generals of Louis XV were foreigners. Lavendel sprang from the royal house of Denmark, and Saxe, the best of all, was one of the 354 bastards of Augustus the Strong, Elector of Saxony and King of Poland. He was now, 1750, dying at Chambord, his iron constitution ruined by debaucheries. The triumph of the Bourbon monarchy was complete. The government had become one great machine of centralized administration, with a king for its head, a king who neither could nor would direct it. All strife was over between the crown and the nobles, feudalism was robbed of its vitality, and left the mere image of its former self, with nothing alive but its abuses, its caste privileges, its exactions, its pride and vanity, its power to vex and oppress. In England, the nobility were a living part of the nation, and if they had privileges, they paid for them by constant service to the state. In France, they had no political life, and were separated from the people by sharp lines of demarcation. From warrior chiefs, they had changed to courtiers. Those of them who could afford it, and many who could not, left their estates to the mercy of stewards, and gathered at Versailles to revolve about the throne as glittering satellites, paid in pomp, empty distinctions, or rich sinecures, for the power they had lost. They ruined their vassals to support the extravagance by which they ruined themselves. Such as stayed at home were objects of pity and scorn. "Out of your majesty's presence," said one of them, "we are not only wretched, but ridiculous." Versailles was like a vast and gorgeous theater, where all were actors and spectators at once, and all played their parts to perfection. Here swarmed by thousands this silken nobility, whose ancestors rode cased in iron. Pageant followed pageant. A picture of the time preserves for us an evening in the great hall of the chateau, where the king, with piles of Louis d'or before him, sits at a large oval green table, throwing the dice, among princes and princesses, dukes and duchesses, ambassadors, marshals of France, and a vast throng of courtiers, like an animated bed of tulips, for men and women alike wear bright and varied colors. Above are the frescoes of Lebrun, around are walls of sculptured and inlaid marbles, with mirrors that reflect the restless splendors of the scene and the blaze of chandeliers, sparkling with crystal pendants. Pomp, magnificence, profusion, were a business and a duty at the court. Versailles was a gulf into which the labor of France poured its earnings, and it was never full. Here the graces and charms were a political power. Women had prodigious influence, and the two sexes were never more alike. Men not only dressed in colors, but they wore patches and carried muffs. The robust qualities of the old nobility still lingered among the exiles of the provinces, while at court they had melted into refinements tainted with corruption. Yet, if the butterflies of Versailles had lost virility, they had not lost courage. They fought as gaily as they danced. In the halls which they haunted of yore, turned now into a historical picture gallery, one sees them still, in the canvas of L'Enfant, L'Epeon, or Burnet, facing death with careless gallantry, in their small three-cornered hats, powdered perukes, embroidered coats, and lace ruffles. Their valets served them with ices in the trenches, under the cannon of besieged towns. A troop of actors formed part of the army train of Marshal Saxe. At night there was a comedy, a ballet, or a ball, and in the morning a battle. Saxe, however, himself a sturdy German, while he recognized their fighting value, and knew well how to make the best of it, sometimes complained that they were volatile, excitable, and difficult to manage. The weight of the court, with its pomps, luxuries, and wars, bore on the classes least able to support it. The poorest were taxed most, the richest not at all. The nobles, in the main, were free from imposts. The clergy, who had vast possessions, were wholly free, though they consented to make voluntary gifts to the crown, and when, in a time of emergency, the minister Magault required them, in common with all others hitherto exempt, to contribute a 20th of their revenues to the charges of government, they passionately refused, declaring that they would obey God rather than the king. The cultivators of the soil were ground to the earth by a threefold extortion, the seigneurial dues, the tithes of the church, and the multiplied exactions of the crown, enforced with merciless rigor by the farmers of the revenue, who enriched themselves by wringing the peasant in the one hand, and cheating the king on the other. A few great cities shone with all that is most brilliant in society, intellect, and concentrated wealth, while the country that paid the costs lay in ignorance and penury, crushed and despairing. Of the inhabitants of towns, too, the demands of the tax-gatherer were extreme, but here the immense vitality of the French people bore up the burden. While agriculture languished, and intolerable oppression turned peasants into beggars or desperados, while the clergy were sapped by corruption, and the nobles enervated by luxury and ruined by extravagance, the middle class was growing in thrift and strength. Arts and commerce prospered, and the seaports were alive with foreign trade. Wealth tended from all sides towards the center. The king did not love his capital, but he and his favorites amused themselves with adorning it. Some of the chief embellishments that make Paris what it is today, the Place de la Concorde, the Champs-Élysées, and many of the palaces of the Faubourg Street, Germain date from this reign. One of the vicious conditions of the time was the separation in sympathies and interests of the four great classes of the nation, clergy, nobles, burghers, and peasants, and each of these, again, divided itself into incoherent fragments. France was an aggregate of disjointed parts, held together by a meshwork of arbitrary power, itself touched with decay. A disastrous blow was struck at the national welfare when the government of Louis XV revived the odious persecution of the Huguenots. The attempt to scour heresy out of France cost her the most industrious and virtuous part of her population, and robbed her of those most fit to resist the mocking skepticism and turbid passions that burst out like a deluge with the revolution. Her manifold ills were summed up in the king. Since the Valois, she had had no monarch so worthless. He did not want understanding, still less the graces of person. In his youth the people called him the well-beloved, but by the middle of the century they so detested him that he dared not pass through Paris, lest the mob should execrate him. He had not the vigor of the true tyrant, but his languor, his hatred of all effort, his profound selfishness, his listless disregard of public duty, and his effeminate libertinism, mixed with superstitious devotion, made him no less a national curse. Louis XIII was equally unfit to govern, but he gave the reins to the great cardinal. Louis XV abandoned them to a frivolous mistress, content that she should rule on condition of amusing him. It was a hard task, yet Madame de Pompadour accomplished it by methods infamous to him and to her. She gained and long kept the power that she coveted, filled the Bastille with her enemies, made and unmade ministers, appointed and removed generals. Great questions of policy were at the mercy of her caprices. Through her frivolous vanity, her personal likes and dislikes, all the great departments of government, army, navy, war, foreign affairs, justice, finance changed from hand to hand incessantly, and this at a time of crisis, when the kingdom needed the steadiest and surest guidance. Few of the officers of state, except, perhaps, D'Argenson, could venture to disregard her. She turned Allori, the controller general, put her favorite, Matchalt, into his place, then made him keeper of the seals, and at last minister of marine. The Marquis de Puissux, in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the Comte de Saint Florentin, charged with the affairs of the clergy, took their cue from her. The king stinted her in nothing. First and last, she is reckoned to have cost him 36 million francs, answering not to more than as many dollars. The prestige of the monarchy was declining with the ideas that had given it life and strength. A growing disrespect for king, ministry, and clergy was beginning to prepare the catastrophe that was still some 40 years in the future. While the valleys and low places of the kingdom were dark with misery and squalor, its heights were bright with a gay society, elegant, fastidious, witty, craving the pleasures of the mind as well as of the senses, criticizing everything, analyzing everything, believing nothing. Voltaire was in the midst of it, fading, with all his vehement soul, the abuses that swarmed about him, and assailing them with the inexhaustible shafts of his restless and piercing intellect. Montesquieu was showing to a despot ridden age the principles of political freedom. Diderot and D'Alembert were beginning their revolutionary encyclopedia. Rousseau was sounding the first notes of his mad eloquence, the wild revolt of a passionate and diseased genius against a world of falsities and wrongs. The salons of Paris, cloyed with other pleasures, alive to all that was racy and new, welcomed the pungent doctrines, and played with them, as children play with fire, thinking no danger, as time went on, even embraced them in a genuine spirit of hope and goodwill for humanity. The revolution began at the top, in the world of fashion, birth, and intellect, and propagated itself downwards. We walked on a carpet of flowers, Count Seger afterwards said, unconscious that it covered an abyss till the gulf yawned at last, and swallowed them. Eastward, beyond the Rhine, lay the heterogeneous patchwork of the Holy Roman, or Germanic, Empire. The sacred bonds that throughout the Middle Ages had held together its innumerable fragments, had lost their strength. The empire decayed as a whole, but not so the parts that composed it. In the south, the House of Austria reigned over a formidable assemblage of states, and in the north the House of Brandenburg, promoted to royalty half a century before, had raised Prussia into an importance far beyond her extent and population. In her dissevered rags of territory lay the destinies of Germany. It was the late king, that honest, thrifty, dogged, headstrong despot, Frederick William, who had made his kingdom what it was, trained it to the perfection of drill, and left it to his son, Frederick II, the best engine of war in Europe. Frederick himself had passed between the upper and nether millstones of paternal discipline. Never did prince undergo such an apprenticeship. His father set him to the work of an overseer, or steward, flung plates at his head in the family circle, thrashed him with his rattan in public, bullied him for submitting to such treatment, and imprisoned him for trying to run away from it. He came at last out of purgatory, and Europe felt him to her farthest bounds. This bookish, philosophizing, verse-making cynic and profligate was soon to approve himself the first warrior of his time, and one of the first of all time. Another power had lately risen on the European world. Peter the Great, half hero, half savage, had roused the inert barbarism of Russia into a titanic life. His daughter Elizabeth had succeeded to his throne, heiress of his sensuality, if not of his talents. Over all the continent the aspect of the times was the same. Power had everywhere left the plains and the lower slopes, and gathered at the summits. Popular life was at a stand. No great idea stirred the nations to their depths. The religious convulsions of the 16th and 17th centuries were over, and the earthquake of the French Revolution had not begun. At the middle of the 18th century, the history of Europe turned in the balance of power. The observance of treaties, inheritance and succession, rivalries of sovereign houses struggling to win power or keep it, encroach on neighbors, or prevent neighbors from encroaching, bargains, intrigue, force, diplomacy, and the musket, in the interest not of peoples but of rulers. Princes, great and small, brooded over some real or fancied wrong, nursed some dubious claim born of a marriage, a will, or an ancient covenant fished out of the abyss of time, and watched their moment to make it good. The general opportunity came when, in 1740, the Emperor Charles VI died and bequeathed his personal dominions of the House of Austria to his daughter, Maria Theresa. The chief powers of Europe had been pledged in advance to sustain the will, and pending the event, the veteran Prince Eugene had said that 200,000 soldiers would be worth all their guarantees together. The 200,000 were not there, and not a sovereign kept his word. They flocked to share the spoil, and parcel out the motley heritage of the young queen. Frederick of Prussia led the way, invaded her province of Silesia, seized it, and kept it. The Elector of Bavaria and the King of Spain claimed their share, and the Elector of Saxony and the King of Sardinia prepared to follow the example. France took part with Bavaria, and intrigued to set the imperial crown in the head of the Elector, thinking to ruin her old enemy, the House of Austria, and rule Germany through an emperor too weak to dispense with her support. England, jealous of her designs, trembling for the balance of power, and anxious for the Hanoverian possessions of her king, threw herself into the strife in the side of Austria. It was now that, in the Diet of Presburg, the beautiful and distressed queen, her infant in her arms, made her memorable appeal to the wild chivalry of her Hungarian nobles, and, clashing their swords, they shouted with one voice, "Let us die for our king, Maria Theresa, Mortimer pro rege nostro, Maria." One of the most dramatic scenes in history, not quite true, perhaps, but near the truth. Then came that confusion worse confounded called the War of the Austrian Succession, with its mullets, its dead engine, its Fontenoy, and its Scotch episode of Culloden. The Peace of Aix-la-Chapelle closed the strife in 1748. Europe had time to breathe, but the germs of discord remained alive. The American combatants. The French claimed all America, from the Alleghenies to the Rocky Mountains, and from Mexico and Florida to the North Pole, except only the ill-defined possessions of the English in the borders of Hudson Bay, and to these vast regions, with adjacent islands, they gave the general name of New France. They controlled the highways of the continent, for they held its two great rivers. First, they had seized the St. Lawrence, and then planted themselves at the mouth of the Mississippi. Canada at the north, and Louisiana at the south, were the keys of a boundless interior, rich with incalculable possibilities. The English colonies, ranged along the Atlantic coast, had no royal road to the great inland, and were, in a manner, shut between the mountains and the sea. At the middle of the century they numbered, in all, from Georgia to Maine, about 1,160,000 white inhabitants. By the census of 1754, Canada had but 55,000. Had those of Louisiana and Acadia, and the whole white population under the French flag might be something more than 80,000. Here is an enormous disparity, and hence it has been argued that the success of the English colonies and the failure of the French was not due to difference of religious and political systems, but simply to numerical preponderance. But this preponderance itself grew out of a difference of systems. We have said before, and it cannot be said too often, that in making Canada the citadel of the state religion, the holy of holies of exclusive Roman Catholic Orthodoxy, the clerical monitors of the crown robbed their country of a transatlantic empire. New France could not grow with a priest in guard at the gate to let in none but such as pleased him. One of the ablest of Canadian governors, La Galissonière, seeing the feebleness of the colony compared with the vastness of its claims, advised the king to send 10,000 peasants to occupy the valley of the Ohio, and hold back the British swarm that was just then pushing its advance guard over the Alleghenies. It needed no effort of the king to people his waste domain, not with 10,000 peasants, but with 20 times 10,000 Frenchmen of every station, the most industrious, most instructed, most disciplined by adversity and capable of self-rule, that the country could boast. While La Galissonière was asking for colonists, the agents of the crown, set on by priestly fanaticism, or designing selfishness masked with fanaticism, were pouring volleys of musketry into the Huguenot congregations, imprisoning for life those innocent of all but their faith, the men in the galleys, the women in the pestiferous dungeons of Aigues-Mortes, hanging their ministers, kidnapping their children, and reviving, in short, the dragonades. Now, as in the past century, many of the victims escaped to the British colonies, and became a part of them. The Huguenots would have hailed, as a boon, the permission to emigrate under the fleur-de-lis, and built up a Protestant France in the valleys of the West. It would have been a bane of absolutism, but a national glory, would have set bounds to English colonization, and changed the face of the continent. The opportunity was spurned. The dominant church clung to its policy of rule and ruin. France built its best colony in a principle of exclusion, and failed. England reversed the system, and succeeded. I have shown elsewhere the aspects of Canada, where the rigid scion of the old European tree was set to grow in the wilderness. The military governor, holding his miniature court in the Rock of Quebec, the feudal proprietors, whose domains lined the shores of the St. Lawrence, the peasant, the roving bushranger, the half-tamed savage, with crucifix and scalping knife, priests, friars, nuns, and soldiers, mingled to form a society the most picturesque in the continent. What distinguished it from the France that produced it was a total absence of revolt against the laws of its being, an absolute conservatism, an unquestioning acceptance of church and king. The Canadian, ignorant of everything but what the priest saw fit to teach him, had never heard of Voltaire, and if he had known him, would have thought him a devil. He had, it is true, a spirit of insubordination born of the freedom of the forest, but if his instincts rebelled, his mind and soul were passively submissive. The unchecked control of a hierarchy robbed him of the independence of intellect and character, without which, under the conditions of modern life, a people must resign itself to a position of inferiority. Yet Canada had a vigor of her own. It was not in spiritual deference only that she differed from the country of her birth. Whatever she had caught of its corruptions, she had caught nothing of its effeminacy. The mass of her people lived in a rude poverty, not abject, like the peasant of old France, nor ground down by the tax-gatherer, while those of the higher ranks all more or less engaged in pursuits of war or adventure, and inured to rough journeyings and forest exposures, were rugged as their climate. Even the French regular troops, sent out to defend the colony, caught its hardy spirit, and set an example of stubborn fighting which their comrades at home did not always emulate. Canada lay ensconced behind rocks and forests. All along her southern boundaries, between her and her English foes, lay a broad tract of wilderness, shaggy with primeval woods. Innumerable streams gurgled beneath their shadows, innumerable lakes gleamed in the fiery sunsets, innumerable mountains bared their rocky foreheads to the wind. These wastes were ranged by her savage allies, Micmacs, Itetamans, Abenakis, Gondogagis, and no enemy could steal upon her unawares. Through the midst of them stretched Lake Champlain, pointing straight to the heart of the British settlement, a watery thoroughfare of mutual attack, and the only approach by which, without a long detour by wilderness or sea, a hostile army could come within striking distance of the colony. The French advanced post of Fort Frederick, called Crown Point by the English, barred the narrows of the lake, which thence spread northward to the portals of Canada guarded by Fort Street. Jean. Southwestward, some 1,400 miles, as a bird flies, and twice, as far by the practicable routes of travel, was Louisiana, the second of the two heads of New France, while between lay the realms of solitude, where the Mississippi rolled its sullen tide, and the Ohio wound its belt of silver through the verdant woodlands. To whom belonged this world of prairies and forests? France claimed it by right of discovery and occupation. It was her explorers who, after De Soto, first set foot on it. The question of right, it is true, mattered little, for, right or wrong, neither claimant would yield her pretensions so long as she had strength to uphold them. Yet one point is worth a moment's notice. The French had established an excellent system in the distribution of their American lands. Whoever received a grant from the crown was required to improve it, and this within reasonable time. If he did not, the land ceased to be his, and was given to another more able or industrious. An international extension of her own principle would have destroyed the pretensions of France to all the countries of the West. She had called them hers for 3/4 of a century, and they were still a howling waste, yielding nothing to civilization but beaver skins, with here and there a fort, trading post, or mission, and 3 or 4 puny hamlets by the Mississippi and the Detroit. We have seen how she might have made for herself an indisputable title, and peopled the solitudes with a host to maintain it. She would not, others were at hand who both would and could, and the late claimant, disinherited and forlorn, would soon be left to count the cost of her bigotry. The 13 British colonies were alike, insomuch, as they all had representative governments, and a basis of English law. But the differences among them were great. Some were purely English, others were made up of various races, though the Anglo-Saxon was always predominant. Some had one prevailing religious creed, others had many creeds. Some had charters, and some had not. In most cases the governor was appointed by the crown. In Pennsylvania and Maryland he was appointed by a feudal proprietor, and in Connecticut and Rhode Island he was chosen by the people. The differences of disposition and character were still greater than those of form. The 4 northern colonies, known collectively as New England, were an exception to the general rule of diversity. The smallest, Rhode Island, had features all its own, but the rest were substantially one in nature and origin. The principal among them, Massachusetts, may serve as the type of all. It was a mosaic of little village republics, firmly cemented together, and formed into a single body politic through representatives sent to the general court at Boston. Its government, originally theocratic, now tended to democracy, ballasted, as yet, by strong traditions of respect for established worth and ability, as well as by the influence of certain families prominent in affairs for generations. Yet there were no distinct class lines, and popular power, like popular education, was widely diffused. Practically, Massachusetts was almost independent of the mother country. Its people were purely English, of sound yeoman stock, with an abundant leaven drawn from the best of the Puritan gentry, but their original character had been somewhat modified by changed conditions of life. A harsh and exacting creed, with its stiff formalism and its prohibition of wholesome recreation, excess in the pursuit of gain the only resource left to energies robbed of their natural play, the struggle for existence on a hard and barren soil, and the isolation of a narrow village life, joined to produce, in the meaner sort, qualities which were unpleasant, and sometimes repulsive. Puritanism was not an unmixed blessing. Its view of human nature was dark, and its attitude towards it one of repression. It strove to crush out not only what is evil, but much that is innocent and salutary. Human nature so treated will take its revenge, and for every vice that it loses find another instead. Nevertheless, while New England Puritanism bore its peculiar crop of faults, it produced also many good and sound fruits. An uncommon vigor, joined to the hardy virtues of a masculine race, marked the New England type. The sinews, it is true, were hardened at the expense of blood and flesh, and this literally as well as figuratively, but the staple of character was a sturdy conscientiousness, an undespairing courage, patriotism, public spirit, sagacity, and a strong good sense. A great change, both for better and for worse, has since come over it, due largely to reaction against the unnatural rigors of the past. That mixture, which is now too common, of cool emotions with excitable brains, was then rarely seen. The New England colonies abounded in high examples of public and private virtue, though not always under the most prepossessing forms. They were conspicuous, moreover, for intellectual activity, and were by no means without intellectual eminence. Massachusetts had produced at least two men whose fame had crossed the sea: Edwards, who out of the grim theology of Calvin mounted to sublime heights of mystical speculation, and Franklin, famous already by his discoveries in electricity. In the other hand, there were a few genuine New Englanders who, however personally modest, could divest themselves of the notion that they belonged to a people in an especial manner the object of divine approval, and this self-righteousness, along with certain other traits, failed to commend the Puritan colonies to the favor of their fellows. Then, as now, New England was best known to her neighbors by her worst side. In one point, however, she found general applause. She was regarded as the most military among the British colonies. This reputation was well founded, and is easily explained. More than all the rest, she lay open to attack. The long waving line of the New England border, with its lonely hamlets and scattered farms, extended from the Kennebec to beyond the Connecticut, and was everywhere vulnerable to the guns and tomahawks of the neighboring French and their savage allies. The colonies towards the south had thus far been safe from danger. New York alone was within striking distance of the Canadian war parties. That province then consisted of a line of settlements up the Hudson and the Mohawk, and was little exposed to attack, except at its northern end, which was guarded by the fortified town of Albany, with its outlying posts, and by the friendly and warlike Mohawks, whose castles were close at hand. Thus New England had borne the heaviest brunt of the preceding wars, not only by the forest, but also by the sea, for the French of Acadia and Cape Breton confronted her coast, and she was often at blows with them. Fighting had been a necessity with her, and she had met the emergency after a method extremely defective, but the best that circumstances would permit. having no trained officers and no disciplined soldiers, and being too poor to maintain either, she borrowed her warriors from the workshop and the plow, and officered them with lawyers, merchants, mechanics, or farmers. To compare them with good regular troops would be folly, but they did, in the whole, better than could have been expected, and in the last war achieved the brilliant success of the capture of Louisburg. This exploit, due partly to native hardihood and partly to good luck, greatly enhanced the military repute of New England, or rather was one of the chief sources of it. The great colony of Virginia stood in strong contrast to New England. In both the population was English, but the one was Puritan with rounded traditions, and the other, so far as concerned its governing class, Anglican with cavalier traditions. In the one, every man, woman, and child could read and write. In the other, Sir William Berkeley once thanked God that there were no free schools, and no prospect of any for a century. The hope had found fruition. The lower classes of Virginia were as untaught as the warmest friend of popular ignorance could wish. New England had a native literature more than respectable under the circumstances, while Virginia had none, numerous industries. While Virginia was all agriculture, with but a single crop, a homogeneous society and a democratic spirit, while her rival was an aristocracy. Virginian society was distinctively stratified. In the lowest level were the Negro slaves, nearly as numerous as all the rest together. Next, the indented servants and the poor whites, of low origin, good-humored, but boisterous, and sometimes vicious. Next, the small and despised class of tradesmen and mechanics. Next, the farmers and lesser planters, who were mainly of good English stock, and who merged insensibly into the ruling class of the great landowners. It was these last who represented the colony and made the laws. They may be described as English country squires transplanted to a warm climate and turned slave masters. They sustained their position by entails, and constantly undermined it by the reckless profusion which ruined them at last. Many of them were well born, with an immense pride of descent, increased by the habit of domination. Indolent and energetic by turns, rich in natural gifts and often poor in book learning, though some, in the lack of good teaching at home, had been bred in the English universities, high-spirited, generous to a fault, keeping open house in their capacious mansions, among vast tobacco fields and toiling negroes, and living in a rude pomp where the fashions of St. James were somewhat oddly grafted in the roughness of the plantation, what they wanted in schooling was supplied by an education which books alone would have been impotent to give, the education which came with the possession and exercise of political power, and the sense of a position to maintain, joined to a bold spirit of independence and a patriotic attachment to the Old Dominion. They were few in number, they raced, gambled, drank, and swore, they did everything that in Puritan eyes was most reprehensible, and in the day of need they gave the United Colonies a body of statesmen and orators which had no equal on the continent. A vigorous aristocracy favors the growth of personal eminence, even in those who are not of it, but only near it. The essential antagonism of Virginia and New England was afterwards to become, and to remain for a century, an element of the first influence in American history. Each might have learned much from the other, but neither did so till, at last, the strife of their contending principles shook the continent. Pennsylvania differed widely from both. She was a conglomerate of creeds and races, English, Irish, Germans, Dutch, and Swedes, Quakers, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Romanists, Moravians, and a variety of nondescript sects. The Quakers prevailed in the eastern districts, quiet, industrious, virtuous, and serenely obstinate. The Germans were strongest towards the center of the colony, and were chiefly peasants, successful farmers, but dull, ignorant, and superstitious. Towards the west were the Irish, of whom some were Celts, always quarreling with their German neighbors, who detested them, but the greater part were Protestants of Scotch descent, from Ulster, a vigorous border population. Virginia and New England had each a strong distinctive character. Pennsylvania, with her heterogeneous population, had none but that which she owed to the sober neutral tints of Quaker existence. A more thriving colony there was not on the continent. Life, if monotonous, was smooth and contented. Trade and the arts grew. Philadelphia, next to Boston, was the largest town in British America, and was, moreover, the intellectual center of the middle and southern colonies. Unfortunately, for her credit in the approaching war, the Quaker influence made Pennsylvania non-combatant. Politically, too, she was an anomaly, for, though utterly unfeudal in disposition and character, she was under feudal superiors in the persons of the representatives of William Penn, the original grantee. New York had not, as yet, reached the relative prominence which her geographical position and inherent strength afterwards gave her. The English, joined to the Dutch, the original settlers, were the dominant population, but a half score of other languages were spoken in the province, the chief among them being that of the Huguenot French in the southern parts, and that of the Germans in the Mohawk. In religion, the province was divided between the Anglican Church, with government support and popular dislike, and numerous dissenting sects, chiefly Lutherans, Independents, Presbyterians, and members of the Dutch Reformed Church. The little city of New York, like its great successor, was the most cosmopolitan place in the continent, and probably the gayest. It had, in abundance, balls, concerts, theatricals, and evening clubs, with plentiful dances and other amusements, for the poorer classes. Thither in the winter months came the great hereditary proprietors in the Hudson, for the old Dutch feudality still held its own, and the manors of Van Rensselaer, Cortland, and Livingston, with their seigneurial privileges, and the great estates and numerous tenantry of the Schuylers and other leading families, formed the basis of an aristocracy, some of whose members had done good service to the province, and were destined to do more. Pennsylvania was feudal in form, and not in spirit, Virginia in spirit, and not in form, New England in either, and New York largely in both. This social crystallization had, it is true, many opponents. In politics, as in religion, there were sharp antagonisms and frequent quarrels. They centered in the city, for in the well-stocked dwellings of the Dutch farmers along the Hudson there reigned a tranquil and prosperous routine, and the Dutch border town of Albany had not its like in America for unruffled conservatism and quaint picturesqueness.
Of the other colonies, the briefest mention will suffice. New Jersey, with its wholesome population of farmers, tobacco-growing Maryland, which, but for its proprietary government and numerous Roman Catholics, might pass for another Virginia, inferior in growth, and less decisive in features, Delaware, a modest appendage of Pennsylvania, wild and rude North Carolina, and, farther on, South Carolina and Georgia, too remote from the seat of war to take a noteworthy part in it. The attitude of these various colonies towards each other is hardly conceivable to an American of the present time. They had no political tie, except a common allegiance to the British crown.
Communication between them was difficult and slow, by rough roads traced often through primeval forests. Between some of them there was less of sympathy than of jealousy kindled by conflicting interests or perpetual disputes concerning boundaries. The patriotism of the colonist was bounded by the lines of his government, except in the compact and kindred colonies of New England, which were socially united, through politically distinct. The country of the New Yorker was New York, and the country of the Virginian was Virginia. The New England colonies had once confederated, but, kindred, as they were, they had long ago dropped apart. William Penn proposed a plan of colonial union wholly fruitless. James II tried to unite all the northern colonies under one government, but the attempt came to naught. Each stood aloof, jealously independent. At rare intervals, under the pressure of an emergency, some of them would try to act in concert, and, except in New England, the results had been most discouraging. Nor was it the segregation only that unfitted them for war. They were all subject to popular legislatures, through whom alone money and men could be raised, and these elective bodies were sometimes factious and selfish, and not always either far-sighted or reasonable. Moreover, they were in a state of ceaseless friction with their governors, who represented the king, or, what was worse, the feudal proprietary. These disputes, though varying in intensity, were found everywhere, except in the two small colonies which chose their own governors, and they were premonitions of the movement towards independence which ended in the War of Revolution. The occasion of difference mattered little. Active or latent, the quarrel was always present. In New York it turned in a question of the governor's salary, in Pennsylvania in the taxation of the proprietary estates, in Virginia in a fee exacted for the issue of land patents. It was sure to arise whenever some public crisis gave the representatives of the people an opportunity of extorting concessions from the representative of the crown, or gave the representative of the crown an opportunity to gain a point for prerogative. That is to say, the time when action was most needed was the time chosen for obstructing it. In Canada there was no popular legislature to embarrass the central power. The people, like an army, obeyed the word of command, a military advantage beyond all price. Divided in government, divided in origin, feelings, and principles, jealous of each other, jealous of the crown, the people at war with the executive, and, by the fermentation of internal politics, blinded to an outward danger that seemed remote and vague, such were the conditions under which the British colonies drifted into a war that was to decide the fate of the continent. This war was the strife of a united and concentric few against a divided and discordant many. It was the strife, too, of the past against the future, of the old against the new, of moral and intellectual torpor against moral and intellectual life, of barren absolutism against a liberty, crude, incoherent, and chaotic, yet full of prolific vitality.